Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is All of It. I'm Allison Stewart, and we are continuing All of It, the summer edition. I am broadcasting from a cottage in Oak Bluffs on Martha's Vineyard. So while we are, I'm here with my family, we thought we'd explore some fascinating history of the area. For more than 200 years, whaling ranked among the country's largest industries. Of course, the way we think about fishing and whaling and how we treat creatures of the sea has changed dramatically. But once upon a time in this country, whaling and the oil that it was harvested from whales was crucial to the American economy, and it made some of the men who went to sea for years very wealthy. But it wasn't easy. Whaling has been described as, quote, a cross between working in an oil refinery and a slaughterhouse with the chance of drowning thrown in. In part because of the danger and hardship of whaling, historian Skip Finley argues that it became America's first meritocracy, and the industry located in New England was diverse. As many as 20-30% of the men who went whaling were men of color. And at a time when a Fugitive Slave Act could be enforced throughout the South, 52 of them became captains. Skip Finley profiles all 52 in his latest book, Whaling Captains of Color, America's First Meritocracy. Skip's been writing about Martha's Vineyard for years for the Vineyard Gazette and other island publications. This after a long career in radio. He was responsible for 44 radio stations encompassing 18 markets, five of which the stations he owned. My favorite part of his bio says he's been trying to retire since he was 50. Skip, welcome to All of It.
Thank you very much. I love the name of your show. I can't believe how much we have in common and how we haven't met yet and why we're not sitting across a desk doing this interview. You're like 3 miles away.
In some other world, if things were a little bit better, we could do that. Maybe next summer. Your next book, we'll write. We'll do it that way.
You got it. That'll be great.
So you write that the life of Captain William A. Martin inspired this book. What was it about his story that prompted you to dive into this history?
Well, the famous, actually the last American whaling ship, the Charles W. Morgan, was completely restored and refloated from Mystic, Connecticut, and took a trip to the Northeast, up to Martha's Vineyard was one of the stops, of course, New Bedford, Snow Wagon Bank, and some other places. It was extraordinarily important to the island of Martha's Vineyard because its first seven captains came from here. Many of its crew members, you know, came from here. And ironically, its last captain happened to have been a man of color, Cape Verdean. Anyway, I was writing the Oak Bluffs Town column for the Vineyard Gazette, and I was asked to write a piece for Martha's Vineyard magazine that devoted its entire May-June issue in 2014 to the Charles W. Morgan. And of course, I was delighted to do it. It was a new writer. This is my first magazine article, and I started doing research on Captain William A. Martin. And it didn't take long for me to ask myself the question, how in the hell did a black man become captain of a whale ship in the 1800s? Well, one thing led to another, and I got completely carried away, as I have wont to do, on ADHD and OCD. So before I knew it, I'd, bought 100 and some whaling books, or pretty much all the whaling books, and read them all and took notes. And this book came out of it. I was just astounded, by this fact. And then repeatedly astounded, because then I found out that he wasn't not only not the only black whaling captain, but not even close to the first, who was Paul Cuffey, who had his own boat as a captain during the Revolutionary War.
Yeah, Paul Cuffey was very interesting because you write about how he owned three brigs, including a schooner. How was he able to buy his own ship by the age of 25?
Most of them, his early ones, he and his brother built. Their dad was a carpenter, and, I guess one thing led to another, but they would build these boats. Cuffey believed to have been a natural navigator and was an excellent one. He and his brother used those boats to transport goods back and forth from, the Dartmouth, New Bedford area to Martha's Vineyard, Nantucket at night during the blockade by the British. In fact, Cuffey was captured by the British once and captured by pirates at least once, or perhaps twice, incredibly enough, and let go each of those times. So the story just got more and more and more and more and more interesting.
You write also, that's so interesting, you write his family and his descendants were like a dynasty, yet as you point out in the book, he couldn't vote and he couldn't sit on a jury. So you had these captains who are making this money and in charge, but in what other ways were they marginalized because of their color?
Pretty much all, which is a huge difference. Most people know little about whaling other than what they were supposed to have read when they did not read Moby Dick, like me and all the rest of us. And that's, you know, a romantic tale based on a real whaling ship that Herman Melville took on the Acushnet years ago, around 1840. In fact, however, it was one of the most difficult businesses, which is the answer to the question that I'm asked often, you know, what do you mean by meritocracy? Well, no one cared who you were if 1,200 miles out to sea something happened to the captain, mm-hmm. and you could get the ship and the whale products home, which is what happened, because we could only go back and forth to do whaling over and over again in a business marked by being so awful that probably 90% of the people who went on a whaling trip only took one trip and wanted to get off that whale ship as fast as they can. Now, comparatively, the other little-known romantic tale is that a whaling captain was virtually omnipotent. You could be flogged by a captain. You know, you could do anything you wanted with a crew, because the average trip took 3.5 to 4 years, and you had to maintain discipline of a crew ranging in size from, a dozen to 30-some people on board the ship. You couldn't have people talking back. You couldn't have fighting. You couldn't have disorder of any kind. So even a black man who was a captain could flog a white person who on land they couldn't look in the eye.
Wow. That's wild. The name of the book is Whaling Captains of Color, America's First Meritocracy. My guess is its author, Skip Finley. And I want to read a little bit that you write about after you get excited by William Martin and you go for a walk around Edgartown on Martha's Vineyard, which is a whaling area. A prominent whaling area. You write, "For the first time, I realized the importance of whaling in American history. Although I was an adult before, I discovered that whaling had more to do with oil than food. Now, as I walk through the town in the dead of winter, largely absence of tourists, the white Federalist-style homes with black shutters and white picket fences stand out on the bare landscape. Above the doors are dates from the 18th and 19th centuries boasting of their antiquity and marking an important part of American history. During those 2 centuries, black people were enslaved in America and then freed. The simple elegance of these wooden homes belies their cost and the sacrifices their owners made thousands of miles away at sea to pay for them. Looking at the widow's walks on their roofs, one wonders what a captain's loved ones must have felt, longing, joy, dread, when a ship appeared on the horizon, not knowing whether he had survived a voyage that could have taken several years." Skip, why was the risk worth it for people of color?
Well, it was an occupation that you could pursue, and for we, it was a prized occupation by the people who pursued whaling. In the very beginning, it was the Native American community that began whaling, which was from drift whales, or a whale would die, would wash up on shore, and the natives would use the products that the whale provided, you know, for their purposes, sometimes for food, more often than not, for building materials, for example. Whaling burgeoned originally on the island of Nantucket, except when the white man came to the New World, one of the things they brought with them was disease. And many of the native population was wiped out prior to the mid-1700s. And the Quakers, who had established whaling more so than anyone else as an industry, recruited black people to take their place, generally as harpooners. You know, much of whaling is so physical, it's so hard. You know, it's incredible, you know, to imagine. From the time when, you know, you're the 16-year-old rookie or green hand, and you're called that because it wasn't too many hours at sea before your lunch was coming back up. And they call these people green hand because that's the color of their faces.
Wow.
The most exciting thing you were probably going to hear was the first time you heard "thar blows," or "blows" is probably the more accurate way of expressing when the lookout saw the whale for the first time. Well, then the captain says, you, and you, 6 people, run over, they put you into a whale boat, which is about 30 feet long. They lower you to the water, you row towards that whale till you catch up to it. And one person takes a harpoon and sticks it into a creature that's probably as long as the whale ship, the big whale ship, not the small 30-foot one, but the 100-foot one, you know, and weighing several tons, as many as 50 or in some cases, you know, 90 tons. Then as the whale tires and runs away, you're on what they call the Nantucket sleigh ride for an indeterminate amount of time and distance. Once the whale slowed down, then you got closer and you stabbed it and stabbed it and stabbed it until finally you killed the thing. You're surrounded in a sea of blood, and if it's a sperm whale regurgitation. And after you've captured it, you latch up onto it and you tow it back to the boat, which may be 4 to 8 miles away at the time. So that's how whaling starts, and it goes downhill from there.
Oh, my goodness. One of the things I thought was also quite interesting in the book is that you note that these captains of color, they fought for change on land as well, and you write about a man named Prince Boston, an excellent sailor who fought for his rights. How did his case help bring the end of slavery on Nantucket?
Well, okay. Prince Boston was enslaved on the island of Nantucket. He was hired out by his master to go on a whaling trip. He did so well on the trip that the captain of the boat decided to pay him directly and not pay the money to his owner, which was the practice at the time. The owner sued to collect those wages. Well, actually, that guy who did it died. His son sued to collect those wages and pretty much lost the suit. The net result of it was Prince Boston and the rest of the family of slaves were freed soon after that. So this occurred in 1772. By 1775, the last, his two brothers, were freed from slavery. So Nantucket had free black people before America was free.
It's extraordinary. The name of the book is Whaling Captains of Color, America's First Meritocracy. Its author is Skip Finley. So in our last few moments, Skip, it's very clearly Whaling Captains of Color. Would you explain to our audience why that title?
Yes. I'm of an age and have grown up, you know, from being, you know, Negro and black and African American. And those terms were inapplicable when whaling took place. This is a business that began in the, you know, mid-late 1600s as an industry in the early 1700s and lasted until 1928. Well, those years we would probably look back and recall we black people were wholly enslaved, you know, and then by time Reconstruction rolled around, you know, we found that the South that lost the war won the argument. So it's very difficult to say that these people were, you know, well, black wasn't useful. You couldn't call them American because we weren't until 1865 or 69, depending how you view Juneteenth. And we weren't all black. Over the years, since 1619, we were not just harvested as slaves, but we were grown almost as produce when those 389,000 people became 3.9 people freed at the end of the Civil War. Well, not all of those relationships were black people making more black people. Mm-hmm. So our skin colors, you know, changed over the years. In whaling, a crucial document that allowed me to find many people was called the Seamen's Protection Certificate, which was a device that would function almost, not quite, but almost like a passport. And back when the British were impressing our sailors in the Revolutionary War, and then again in the War of 1812, that was a document that men could produce to say, we're Americans. We belong to this country over here. Otherwise, they would kill you, leave you there, you know, or put you to work. Well, these papers defined and described how you looked. Mm-hmm. So the myriad of colors that, you know, folks are described as, it could be white, it could be light, it could be dark. But there was copper, it was yellow, it was brown, it was black. So all of a sudden, the just black people part, along with the American part for much of the history of whaling, didn't make sense. Add to that, the people who were brought to the West Indies you know, how would you describe a West Indian, you know, who was certainly not American.
Right.
As well, he went on in the years, as my friend Al Vicente, K. Virgin, said to me,
yeah,
we're the people who came to America on purpose.
The name of the book is Whaling Captains of Color, America's First Meritocracy. It is by Skip Finley, and it is fascinating. Skip, thank you so much for making time for us today and walking us through this history.
I do appreciate it. Thank you very much. I look forward to meeting you sometime.
It'll happen. This is All of It on WNYC. I'm Allison Stewart, and I will meet you at the top of the hour.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.